Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hello and welcome. We're up to 10,000 downloads. Isn't that exciting?
It's We've got an official...
official badge,
ooh,
which I managed to put on the website without accidentally screwing it up completely and utterly on the fifth attempt.
What does it say or do?
It just says 10,000 downloads, that's all. It's one of those nice circular things that makes you think, golly.
We did a thing.
We did a thing and we're continuing to do a thing.
We are.
And we're still not meeting, but we're closer.
We're closer. Next week.
Next week.
It's pretty freaking exciting.
There better be cake.
We'll be cake.
We'll both make cake and both of us will probably go, oh no, fancy any cakes.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, cake. Mm-hmm. I found out, because I was talking to the bishop earlier this morning, that's what I call my bishop when he's not listening, because he doesn't listen to these, and we were talking about hot cross buns.
As you do.
Well, he brought the subject up because we were talking about Easter and all the things I'd done wrong with the Easter masses. But sometimes when you work on your own, which I do very much, we are edge priests. We're out in the world. We don't have a cosy little congregation. We're supposed to be out there helping out in the supermarket, doing this, that kind of other. But when you're doing masses on your own or working on your own, you either get into bad habits or you make terrible mistakes. And things like do a mass on a day that's forbidden, for example.
Oops.
Not that the heavens mind at all, but there are certain disciplines and structures that are a good idea to follow.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we've got onto hot cross buns, and he said, "Did I know that they were part of the Egyptian mysteries?"
Intriguing,
isn't? I just love it that all the patterns come round and round and round and round because there is a deep significance.
Yeah,
and they were made because they were in honor of Osiris, who was the god of wheat,
mm-hmm.
and Isis, who was the god of grapes, which is wine. Or raisins,
mm-hmm.
and one day a year they baked these cakes with wheat and raisins,
mm-hmm.
and they were called the cakes of the day of Be With Us.
Oh,
and they were a gift from the gods that we would be with them because we'd taken what the gods had given and which human hands had made from it, and eat them in celebration together. And although these were made in the temples of Isis and Osiris, they were given out to the other gods or the other temples.
Oh, so...
Please excuse the phone in the background. It'll switch off in a minute.
Okay. So, slightly confused. The gods, they were eat cakes with us, as in come and eat cakes with the gods?
Yes.
Or come and eat cakes with the people who
No, it was for us to go and eat cake with the gods.
Oh, that's really cute. I like that.
Yeah.
I love how much my mind's going... Wow, Egyptians ate cake as if that would be news.
Well, it's more like a bun. And it also had this equal cross on it,
mm-hmm.
which represented the horizontal land and the vertical of the gods. So that was the Egyptian idea of that cross.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the Hebrew temple, they put the cross sideways as an X because it was a Hebrew letter.
Okay, because to many a pagan or indeed a sort of shamanic practitioner, the cross is the horizontal of the land and the vertical of the axis to the other world. So
yes, so it would be pretty much the same thing, wouldn't it?
It's the world tree in a way.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I just thought, yeah,
it's the everyman bun.
It's the Isis Osiris bun, but I also like the fact that it does confirm the idea that the wheat, the bread for communion, is the masculine and the wine is the feminine, because it actually does represent the lifeblood.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't represent the menstrual blood, because that's technically death blood, but it does represent the whole cycle of the releasing of the blood and the growing of the blood and the growing of the child, I think.
Wow, intriguing. I've never heard them separated out.
No, I wanted to bring that up so that we could discuss it, because... This may very well be a Christian landing on something more sacred. But I was thinking, yes, of course, the menstrual blood is the expelling, the cleansing, isn't it?
It is, but it's also if you take it less very specifically than the moment of it being released, because it isn't a child.
Yes.
Then it's by its very essence is lifeblood, because if you do not bleed, you cannot fall pregnant.
Thank you. Yes. So it's kind of both, isn't it? It's a cycle. Really. Yeah, lovely. Oh, that's much better. Thank you. Yeah. Because the thing is, this is my job. I go into these mysteries. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough. As a woman who's half witch.
Whoa, she's owning it up now.
But I want to draw the magic out of the feminine that's hidden in here. Because it's been in the patriarchy for so long that even lovely people like my bish have forgotten that it's a dual unified mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that to me, that's one of the things that I will, I understand that you believe what you believe and know what you know and all the rest of it, but I will never be able to get past the fact that it's that Christianity is a religion that, as a whole, celebrates only one half of creation,
yeah,
because it's so completely kind of masculine centric.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you this is a true story.
Okay.
After the Second World War, when the war was over, there were masses celebrated all around the world, and the patriarch, the high cardinal of the USA, I think it was Cardinal Beeman or something, a strange name, but anyway, he was celebrating the mass in Washington, and he was gorgeously attired, as they do, God knows why, but that was the Dominican influence. The Franciscans were poor and the Dominicans were wealthy, and the Dominicans won because the wealthy tend to, and so he's parading up the aisle in his gold robes, and they're waving the censer, the thurible, with all the lovely scent, and they had the good and the great and the not so good and the very great there. And the actress Tallulah Bankhead was there, and she said quite clearly as he passed, "It's a lovely dress, but your handbag's on fire."
Oh, I wonder if she'd gone there on purpose to say that, or whether it just popped out of her mouth.
Oh, I don't think it matters. Wouldn't it be lovely to have that kind of wit?
Oh my goodness. Wow, that's hilarious.
But it's such a sign of thing when things go wrong is when they dress up so much. I mean, it's a lovely thing to do when you're doing mass. The idea is that you wash and you put on clean clothes because you bring yourself as virgin as you can, as in virgin, as in pure, not, but on the other hand, why would it matter at all if you just come in from the garden and you've got dirty fingernails? It's a question of being the best you that you can.
Yes, and I actually could, being constantly the devil's advocate, not literally, but I could easily stand up on either side and speak the kind of defence of all the reasons why you might want to wash and all the reasons why you might just want to come with the dirt under your fingernails.
Exactly, yes.
And I guess which ultimately means then, surely it's what's appropriate in the moment to the individual and to the moment itself.
Yes, but it's not about being lazy.
It's not about being lazy, and it's not about being unacceptable to the gods if you have the God-given soil under your fingernails, you know. And the fact that we get our knickers in such a knot about stuff like that is really shows how completely altogether too often we are looking in the wrong place and elevating the wrong aspect of something to what's important.
Yes, locking into the law rather than the spirit of the law. Yeah, absolutely. No, I get that. And sometimes I'll do the whole rig. And sometimes I just put on the prayer shawl. Sorry, I can't remember the name of it now. The scarf thing.
God. I'm glad that happened to you. I've spent the whole weekend with about a quarter of my vocabulary available to me. I feel like just generally, my IQ has definitely plummeted during lockdown. Mm. Every time I put a mask on, I think I get more stupid. And certainly, I feel as if I can't hear properly when I've got a mask on, which is hilarious and apparently quite common.
I can't hear properly when I'm wearing sunglasses.
But yeah, the menopause, ladies out there of a certain age, is, as they say, not for pussies. Oh my goodness.
No.
It's, yeah, can't remember a word half the time.
No, I'm finding masks give me hot flushes in supermarkets, but it may just be I don't want to be in the supermarket as well. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm quite often standing in the supermarket going, this is insane.
Yeah.
But I am strong. It's not so easy for those who are weak.
Mm.
It's a real big. And I've been quietly putting little notes around in psyches when people have either been going vax or anti-vax. I was sort of going, well, what about those who can't have the vaccination? Mm. Yeah, don't just put Hillary people as won'ts. What about can'ts? And can't is also an emotional state.
Yeah.
And we should never be pushed into doing anything that sits badly with us.
No. Absolutely.
It's anyway, that's a whole different thing. What's the story today, Susan?
Well, excuse me. Today I have the utterly, utterly, utterly beautiful Witch's Wisdom Tarot once again, made by the American witch Phyllis Currot and my delicious friend Danielle Barlow, the artist, who's also a student of mine. And I have come to the place where I have to say that this is my most favourite Oracle deck. I'm just coming back to it over and over and over and over again and have realised that there are some instances where I will reach for another and the spirits will very much tell me, no, that the answer to that's not in there.
Yeah.
You need to go to the runes or you need to go to, sometimes it's very specifically also the fairy oracle that I need to go to, which has obviously got a very particular and different energy from almost any other deck I know, actually. But this, I mean, the images are breathtaking and the wisdom...
Can you wave them at the camera?
...contained in the... Here, look, it's really super cute. I've pulled the Two of Air. Can you see that? Isn't he lovely?
So, hedgehog, dandelion and a tree split in the middle but still thriving. Yeah, beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Yeah, she's an amazing artist, Danielle, and... Yeah, her images speak so much to the spirit of the land and the animate many beings of the land and their relationship. It's gorgeous. And yeah, the book is so wise and so beautifully written. And as someone who knows Danielle, even though the book's been written by Phyllis, I can see and feel the flavour of Danielle's journeys also in here, because her relationship with the land is so deep and so authentic. So it's very, very lovely. Anyway, so we have the Two of Air, which is subtitled Vulnerability. And its wisdom is pay attention. Things are more than they seem. A brown and prickly chestnut trembles, rolls and uncurls into a hedgehog. And then it goes on with a very lovely description of the way in which the landscape is alive. Everything is connected. The land whispers the witch's wisdom, the divine is a breath away. So the essence of this card is openness, connection, trust yourself, trust life. And its counsel is that it's time to let go, to trust, to allow yourself to be vulnerable. Breathe and the trees breathe with you, exchanging the breath of life with you. Breathe and be aware that you are always nurtured by the world to which you are connected. It's time to open to the safety of ever-present divine love. All you need to do is breathe it in. And I thought that was very perfect for us. And I was also very intrigued to discover that this isn't the first time I've noticed this, but I've noticed it enough to name it to myself, that I only have to read or hear the word vulnerability and I will feel vulnerable. It's really interesting.
And will you define vulnerable for me in your terminology?
So in my terminology, to feel vulnerable means that I have enough trust in that moment to allow myself to be really open to what is and to what I'm feeling about it, which for me then typically means that this may be a me thing, it may be a menopause thing, it's probably perhaps specifically a feminine thing, but not necessarily a female thing, that when I'm in that place, if I can feel my heart opening, I'm trusting the time and the place and the person or whatever enough to allow that to happen,
yeah.
is that what sits underneath my heart opening will be tears. Yeah. And that to allow myself to be vulnerable is to allow myself to sit on the edge of tears and see what happens. And I find that intriguing, that that word will evoke that in me nearly every time, which I'm finding in this moment of speaking about it, I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Because previously, maybe were I to sit on the edge of that vulnerability, perhaps what would have happened would have been that I would have closed, not opened.
Exactly, yes. Because somebody once explained to me years ago, and I can't remember who, and I can't remember how right it is, but I think it should be right. It's one of those things that you go, ah. They said that most people think vulnerable, because we talk about a vulnerable child or something, we actually think of somebody who's threatened.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, apparently, the original meaning of vulnerable was to be open, to let everything flow through.
Oh. Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, whereas what we think of as vulnerable is to have the block that stops it and loads up all the grief and the difficulty in you so that you are wounded. We tend to think of vulnerable as being prone to being wounded. Well, that's a definition.
Or, I don't know, needing protection.
Yes, I guess. Good thinking, yeah. Yeah, better definition. But I love the idea of what you're saying, which is to just allow it, allow the feeling of the tears, allow it to flow through, and to, I hate the word, process it, but to be aware of it, giving to it and receiving from it and allowing it through, letting go and letting God, if you like, which would be my terminology.
I like that. So for me, even the word processing is putting a kind of,
yeah, that's a bit
like a closure on
no,
it.
No, I don't like that word. I'm just allowing.
Yeah, allowing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sitting with it. But letting it flow through,
yes,
and not
there's,
hold.
There's
not,
so much of a sense of movement in it,
yeah,
for me. So letting it flow through. And
yes.
The, yeah, to be vulnerable is to be open to the flow,
yes.
I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, this morning I was, I have to go up to see my mother as soon as the doors open a little bit more. I've got to take her around some care homes because she can't take care of herself anymore. And there's a huge emotional thing about that,
of course,
for her, because she's got to give up her house and she's fought this for so long. And actually, I did a 4-day retreat over Easter where I did the wrong mass, but who cares? And I managed to phone her up on Tuesday, having said 4 days away from everything, and heard she'd fallen out of bed again. And it was just, that was a level of vulnerability, was I was able to say to her, Mum, this cannot go on.
Mm.
I cannot endure being afraid for you. Michael cannot endure being afraid for you. Your neighbours are afraid. My cousin who comes around every time you push that button is afraid for you. We don't feel that you are safe.
Yeah.
And we cannot feel safe while we know that you are resisting safety. Do you feel safe, Mum? And she said, no, I don't. And that was the most clear conversation that we've managed to have about the fact we have to move you out of love.
Yeah.
We are not doing what you did with your mother, which was move her because you wouldn't have her in the house. You put her, she went to a care home because my mother hated her.
Oh, dear. Oh, God.
Well, yeah. Whereas Michael and I both offered mother's home with us, she won't come. But there just comes a point where we're saying, we can't take it anymore. Even if you can, we can't.
Yeah.
And it just was, it felt incredibly clear.
Yeah. And well, that must be very clear and to some degree liberating for her to be able to say, yes, I don't feel safe, which means something's got to change,
yes,
doesn't it? So
yes,
therefore maybe she might be finding her way towards actually accepting that a different place could be her home.
Yes. Well, what we're planning to do is give her a few weeks of respite care in a beautiful home, which we really can't afford.
Yeah.
But where she can be rested, looked after, waited on hand and foot, relax. And then hopefully we'll be able to move to somewhere where she can spend the rest of her life in her own flat.
Nice.
With people.
Yeah.
But that place isn't ready yet, you know, so she will have to endure 2 moves, I think. And anyway, we might get up there and find that there's somebody perfect she wants to move in with her. That would be another miracle. I don't care which way it is.
Yeah.
So I can be vulnerable to this working out in the right way. But we've put the vulnerability includes saying, this is not safe now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the last thing on earth you'd want, isn't it? Is the thought that your mum could be spending the entire day having fallen out of bed on the floor in her bedroom,
yeah,
not really able to do anything about it.
Yeah.
That's awful for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And she is in pain, she is in trouble, and part of her wants to go. But of course, there's still some work for her to do, obviously, because she's not going. And part of that work may actually be her daughter standing up and saying, "No, mother! I am not doing to you what you did to Granny. I am doing this because of love." And you might revitalize and have another 10 years. God help us, but you might. And I'm going to try and do everything I can to facilitate your life and death as are perfect.
Yeah.
And this time I have to take charge. And yeah. I don't care whether you think that women have no authority. This is happening. And it works so far. Great. So it's a great lesson for me.
Yeah. And so, in fact, in that conversation, both of you let yourselves be vulnerable, didn't you?
Yes.
Because she owned up to, yes, I don't feel safe.
Yes. Yeah. And it is that important to say, I can't go on this way, Mum. I know I'm miles away.
Yeah.
Like, look, it's...
Yeah.
There you are, here come the tears.
Yeah.
You know, I can't rush up and be with you. And actually, it's much better that I can't, because I would do palliative care. I would cover up. That was the way you trained me. Anne said this to her. You train me to cover it up, your agoraphobia, to cover it up, to tell fibs about you, to say, oh, she's doing something else, rather than she's quivering in a wreck in the corner with a glass of wine. You know, bless her, she's through that now, thank God. But the only way my mother recovered from her agoraphobia and her mental health issues was when I emigrated.
Wow. Because she had to.
Because she had to. She was left in the care of my brother, who looked at her with different eyes and said, no. Whereas I was going, I have to cover, I have to help, I have to help, I can't do anything, I have to help, I can't do anything. Whereas my brother said, wrong medicine. And yeah. She went through hell when they got her, took her off the medicine and had a nervous breakdown, and he basically looked after her. And she's not on medicine now.
Well, hey, breakdown became breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, she did have to have more medicine in the meantime, but she actually did. It was breakdown, breakthrough. Because her whole life story, well, I won't tell her whole life story because nobody's business but hers, was always about being betrayed by those you love.
Mm.
So she had to learn that just because you leave her doesn't mean it's a betrayal.
Yeah.
And that somebody else will come.
Wow, so this is going to be huge. This is going to be huge.
Mm.
If she can really understand that she's there because you love her, not because you've betrayed her or abandoned her or dumped her or
then any she can die
things. Yeah.
When she's ready.
Feeling loved.
Yes.
Nice.
You know, it's
Oh God, may we all have that, eh? To die feeling loved, knowing that we are loved.
Yeah, well, she may continue to reject it because of her childhood she felt that love in the family wasn't safe. So, you know, she passed on that. I'm reading this wonderful guy called Gabor Mate at the moment, who is my go-to author right now for all the people in my life who are needing help but haven't got the spirituality. Because, you see, you and I will always automatically go to when somebody is diseased, say, what happened? What is that built on? What is the foundation that is the bedrock of what is happening now? Where did you lose your spirit? Where did you lose the dance? Where did you lose the song? Where did you get tied down in this, that and the other? But you can't do that with the majority of people because mental health issues are still a little bit
vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerable. But not in a good way. And Gabor Mate, being a Canadian doctor and GP who's worked with the dying, is doing all about this mind-body link, about how when we're children we have to attach. And we went wrong. It's coming together again and again when we stopped being hunter-gatherers. It started going wrong. It was okay in the villages but when you were moving around, there was always someone to pick up the child.
Mm-hmm.
The child always had an adult, not necessarily the parents. That didn't matter. They knew there was always somebody who would take care of them.
Mm.
And that's how Jesus's parents didn't notice he wasn't there when they were going back from Jerusalem, and suddenly realised half a day on he wasn't with the group and had to go back to Jerusalem to find out where he was, because the children would run between all the adults. So village life was fine.
Mm.
But now we have this life where, and we've had even more this last year, where families are really isolated.
Yeah.
And there may be two parents or one parent, and visiting parent, maybe some grandparents, but the child attaches far too much to their peers. And this is the Facebook generation, because we're attached to what our peers think about us. We need the dopamine of their likes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just drops into place.
Terrifying prospect, yeah.
Yeah, because we haven't, and he said there's four, you lose, a child desperately needs four attachments, parents, education, work, you know, the learning, I can't remember what the third one was, the fourth one is the land.
No, I was going to say, one of them's got to be place.
Absolutely got to be connection to the land, and hopefully some people have got more connection with the land this last year, but we're so disconnected. Mm. And it's so nice to be able to say to family and people like that, oh, why don't you read this? You've got a difficult diagnosis. This is a medical doctor.
Yeah.
There's no wanky bollocks.
And he's a psycho... Isn't he a qualified psychotherapist?
I'm well not sure. May well doctor? Be. Probably is by
me. Yeah. I know he's written a book about ADD.
Yes.
And he and two of his sons have an ADD diagnosis. Yes. So he's really speaking from
experience
and as well as training, knowledge, new research, etc.
Which is the big kahuna, isn't it? When you've got training, knowledge, wisdom, experience, the whole thing comes together. Yeah. You know, and he starts off his books by saying basically he messed up his kids because he didn't know any better. We all mess up our kids because we didn't know any better. Yeah. He didn't know how damaged he was. And he was born in 1944 in German-occupied Hungary, where his father was away under forced labour and his mother was terrified.
Whoa.
How could the child not pick that up?
Yeah.
You know, so you start picking this stuff up in the womb.
Yeah.
And you learn very fast how to behave to get the security of attachment that you need.
I'm bursting to interrupt there.
Please, I'll shut up there.
Just that. When Dr. Gabor Maté says you start picking this stuff up in the moon, everyone in the womb, everyone goes, ooh, science. When a shamanic practitioner says you start picking that stuff up in the womb, everyone goes, oh, wacky bollocks.
Exactly. And I know it's sad that I'm so delighted that I've got a medical doctor that I can give the book to my friends, but I don't care what level the information goes in. Now it's being disseminated.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, right back to when particle physics, that's probably the wrong name for the branch of physics, but when, guess what, everything's made up of the same stuff and interconnected. You know, can you imagine the snigger that went round up the sleeves of every ancient peoples, every indigenous elder ever, who were like, well, we have been mentioning this for something in excess of 75,000 years. It's jolly nice of you to listen now that science has confirmed. Marvellous. It's like science is some kind of weird religion in that sense.
Yes.
In that, as a culture, we just go, oh, great, you know, science
is a religion.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Medicine is a religion. Yeah, Dr. Maté was saying, you know, that you just don't get trained anything about trauma. And it's quite true. Now, did you, and I know I didn't, but did you, when you had to go to the doctor when you had a diagnosis of cancer, did any of them say, what happened to you?
No, don't be daft. Of course they didn't.
No.
I got a real bee in my bonnet at that time, just because the whole of everything that we were supposed to be undergoing was... supposedly, you know, within the context of the National Health, it's all supposed to be about informed consent. And I'm not slandering the NHS. I owe the NHS my life multiple times and I adore it. And I know that just unbelievably wonderful people work in it. But in this particular instance with this particular consultant, informed consent, my arse.
Yes.
You know, I only found out what kind of operation I'd be having about 20 minutes before it happened. And I hadn't asked because I'd made an assumption that it was one thing and it wasn't. It was another entirely.
Oof.
And, you know, the man was a bit of a bully. He was very, very committed to my way's the only way. And if you don't do it my way, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Basically.
And he was dealing with meat.
Yeah, very much so.
He was a meat merchant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll take this out. You'll be all right.
Yeah.
I'm going to take out what I think I should take out.
Yeah, you don't need it anyway. The idea that you're in any way some, you know, emotionally attached to it is ridiculous. That it will have any impact on you is ridiculous. And anyway, if you don't listen to me,
you'll die.
And shut up and all the rest of it, you'll die.
Yes.
And yeah, it was, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's like the doctors in London putting Henry on a different chemo once they found out that the one that we had researched and thought as it promoted the immune system would not leave him any iller if it didn't work. And he was perfectly capable of walking around and operating perfectly normally when they put him on that treatment. By the end of it, he was dead.
Mm.
You know, and but they didn't put him on the treatment that they said they would. They decided he had a heart murmur and then give him another one without even talking to me. They did talk to him, but actually I was part of that dynamic.
Mm. Mm.
You know, yeah. The whole family is part of the dynamic. And I think one of the things that Gabor... See, I've gone personal now. He's not Dr. Martin.
This is Gabor now, Gabor, is he?
Yeah, okay. Says is that just because you've got stress doesn't matter. The stress is not the problem. The tragedy is not the problem. It's whether you can express it and not process it, bad word again, whether you've got people with whom you can talk to about it. Not forever, not to perpetuate it, not woundology, but if you've got empathy, genuine empathy around you, it doesn't become a problem. And of course, the reason why we do get all these illnesses is because we have cut off.
In shamanism,
What
matters is not what is the story, but what did you make the story mean?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And so, you know, the story is I lost my leg or whatever. Fine. Some people could be, I lost my leg. I'm incredibly lucky to be alive.
Mm.
How extraordinary.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let that stop me
in
my determination to ascend Everest or whatever.
Yeah.
And that person will probably be absolutely fine. Whereas the other person, I lost my leg, my life is over, it's completely ruined, no one's ever going to fancy me again, all my relationships have gone to shit, I'll never be able to do anything, blah, blah, blah.
It should have been spotted earlier, they could have saved the leg.
Exactly.
That person's
going to be ill.
Yeah.
And it's, you know...
But
it's not as simple as that.
No, it's
but
never as
simple
as that.
But that's a big, big, cheesy part of it.
Yeah. Well, I always say to people, somebody said to me the other day, is this... your new go-to guru then? And I said, no, he's another piece in the jigsaw.
Mm.
But it's an important piece.
It is an important piece. Just to go back to that same thing a minute, they did an extraordinary, and I can't remember who they is in this particular instance.
Science-y bods
did an experiment around the whole, what difference does the story make?
Mm.
And they studied a whole bunch of people who had extremely high-stress jobs.
Yeah.
And discovered that there are kind of, just to really make it ABC, that there are two kinds of responses to having a high-stress job. One is, oh my God, the stress is going to kill me.
Mm.
And the other is, I'm incredibly successful. I'm having a brilliant life. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And that the people with that attitude are really healthy. And the people who thought the stress was going to kill them, the stress was killing them. They were, you know, their hearts were up the spout, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there is an argument to say, well, maybe an innate knowing was within those people, knowing that perhaps their particular body wasn't dealing with the stress. So, you know, it's very chicken and egg.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, our minds are such powerful things. If we believe something's going to be doing us harm, then, you know, I really do believe it will do us harm.
Yeah.
But also, the fact that that piece of research was presented as completely concrete evidence that what you think of stress defines what the stress does to you.
Yes.
And the fact that no part of that scientific investigation, as far as I understand it, ever asked the question, but what if those people... actually, this is intuition, and they knew that this level of stress was going to kill them because they already had, you know, an underlying heart thing.
Yes.
To me, that shines a light into science and the way that science is forever defining or reducing the parameters of the questions that you're allowed to ask. That mean that it then goes, see, we've proved it.
Yes, because you can get a definite answer to a simple question.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they did prove it. Or alternatively, if you ask a slightly different question, they proved absolutely nothing.
Mm.
And that's where, to me, science becomes a religion. This idea that it can give us certainties. It can't. It can give us really intriguing insights into something that we can't ever really know.
Same as religion.
Yeah.
It can give us really intriguing insights into something we can never really know.
Yes.
Yeah. But set in stone, breaking the second commandment straight away.
Oh, this is have to remind me what the hell
No graven image.
Oh, okay.
You do not set anything in stone. It doesn't mean say you can't paint or have prettiness. It means you do not say this is the only way it is.
So what's the holly bibble then if it isn't set in stone?
It's absolutely set in stone. Okay. That's the great irony, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there are different translations. And the text is set in stone, but the interpretation should update, but it doesn't. But if you think about some of the ancient laws, it's quite obvious that they were appropriate at the time, but they're not now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some of them, the ones about not sowing two different seeds in a field, two different kinds of seeds in
what?
A field.
No companion planting?
No. No companion planting. You can't mix fibres. You can't mix linen and cotton. Now, there might have been a reason. Maybe they shrink at different rates. And somebody said, oh, don't do that. And somebody set it in stone. But
really? Are you serious? You can't mix linen and cotton is a rule in the Christian church?
No, in the Jewish Orthodox church. In the Old Testament, 613 laws.
Wow, they're really 613 laws?
613. 10 of them are the Ten Commandments. The other 603 are... Don't do this, do that. Interestingly, women are excused from all the should laws because we have enough to do.
Without cool. Having to do that. So there's many things that we shouldn't, but not many.
Oh,
not
lots
many
of things
we
shouldn't. Yes, so not eat shellfish, not eat pork. There was one that I was
not be permitted to be at all remotely present at all if we're bleeding.
Yeah, all that sort of thing.
Not have any authority whatsoever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Marvelous. But at least, hey, we're free from some shoulds.
Yeah. Well, you know, most of them, if you go back into the origin of them, you can go, okay, yeah, I can see why they would say to particularly daft people, not a good idea in a desert culture where we don't have antibiotics and we don't have hot running water and we haven't got all the medicines and the compresses and the this and the that. If you do that and it goes wrong, it will kill you. Don't do it. Mm. Which is good sense. Whereas nowadays... we have sell-by dates and fridges.
Is, if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out, one of the instructions?
It's not one of the laws.
It's not a law.
No, that's a saying of Jesus, but it's an internal one, which is basically, if you're being offended by somebody else, look in your own eye first and take the spar out.
Mm. Well, and also, surely it also encapsulates the idea that we define our experience by the stories we tell about
exactly. it. Exactly, yes. Yeah. Yes, it is all about the story you tell about it. And unless you change the story. I do a lot of healing work with the groups I run, taking them to the upper room, which is the equivalent mm-hmm. that you've got. And we have set up, well, there are set up for us certain areas in the upper room in which we work. And it was made very clear to me that I had to inform them that the first thing they did in any healing work was ask to have their own minds changed about it.
In what asked to have their that own minds
they
changed.
Have to stop seeing the person as diseased or sick.
Oh, wonderful.
And start seeing them as perfect, because that's basically what Jesus did. He just looked at somebody, saw the perfection in them, and drew it up.
Yeah.
So if we go on and say, can I have healing for my sister, please? And then you come back down and go, oh, poor girl, she's still ill. You haven't changed your mind.
No,
so how
you
can
haven't
you
changed
change
anything else, yeah. Ooh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a beautiful, beautiful kind of healing which we call calling forth divine countenance, which is to view the person for whom you are offering. You're basically working with the idea of the warp and weft of the creation mm-hmm. of them.
Yeah.
And to kind of, you know, mend the threads and take out any dandelion seeds or whatever yes. it is that's got in there,
yeah.
But to be able to see them as they're perfect, not in that Barbie or judgmental or yeah. anything way, but as their perfect yeah. self.
To hold them as their perfect self.
Yeah, yeah. Is incredibly mm. healing and potent.
Which is perfect for closing, because warp and weft brings us back to that cross.
To the cross and hot cross buns. Who knew Egyptians eat hot cross buns? Eight. Ancient Egyptians eat hot cross buns. That's an entirely different thing from Egyptians eat hot cross buns.
Yeah, hot cross does sound rather nasty, really. Hot cross buns. Cross buns. Really furious, angry, boiling, menopausal buns.
Bitchy witch buns.
end on that note. We'll see you next week.